Transmitiendo desde la Universidad de Harvard, esto es Procrastinando, un programa de filosofía del derecho con un carácter totalmente informal.
Buenas tardes, días o noches, querido público de la Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, la UNAM. Nos encontramos aquí en la ciudad de Boston, en especial en Cambridge, Massachusetts. Estamos en la Universidad de Harvard con el profesor Mark Tushnet y vamos a hablar sobre diversas cuestiones del derecho constitucional. Pues hemos hecho esta visita gracias al apoyo de la Facultad de Derecho de la UNAM y queremos compartir con todos ustedes pues el conocimiento del maestro. Professor Mark Tushner, welcome to the program.
Thank you for this interview.
Well, first of all, how can we understand the progressive constitutionalism?
I think from my point of view, progressive constitutionalism has one or two core elements. The first is a substantive element, seeking to achieve greater equality, to reach a desirable distribution of wealth and social benefits and welfare, and in a framework of general liberty. That's the substantive content of it. The second point is an institutional concern, which is what are the best governing institutions that will lead us to those results. Now, my own point of view is that in general, we ought to strongly prefer democratic institutions like elected legislatures and executives to as the vehicle for seeking to achieve these progressive substantive outcomes, and in particular should be careful about relying on constitutional courts as the institutions that will do that. I don't think that courts have no role at all. A lot will depend on how effectively the democratic process is working in the society. But the primary thing that I think progressive constitutionalists should be concerned about is achieving a well-functioning democratic system.
What do you think about this European idea of neo-constitutionalism?
I have difficulty understanding exactly what the European idea of neo-constitutionalism is. To some extent, in the U.S. discourse, first of all, it's not a common term. To some extent, it might mirror some notions of a sort of substantive neoliberalism where things should be left more to the market. I am not an enthusiast about that, but if democratic processes produce that result, I am committed to thinking that that's what we ought to, the way we ought to proceed. In other contexts, I think neo-constitutionalism has a much more either progressive or populist tone to it, and includes or is a new version of ideas about multiculturalism and inclusion, and the institutional mechanisms to achieve that. Again, I'm not sure exactly what the concept refers to in that version, but thinking of new democratic mechanisms of inclusion is the kind of thing that I think progressive constitutionalists should be focusing on.
Yes, when we study the Italian approaches to law and some Spanish ones, we found that neoconstitutionalism wants to promote democracy, to promote human rights, to have to maximize the human rights, to maximize the constitution. They normally took all ideas and put it on the constitution. This is like a movement in the law. And it's very interesting that the movement has some followers, but in the United States, maybe they don't know about this movement and have another visions.
Right. So I think that's right. The term is not familiar in the U.S. In principle, we do have in the U.S. a discourse of achieving human rights, which in U.S. constitutional discourse typically means having the courts carry all the weight of this promoting human rights. Again, from my own point of view, I think there's something important in the idea of what I've called the Constitution outside the courts. And I do think that it's valuable for popular movements and political parties to say that our program is implementing the deep values of our Constitution. And in that sense, what you describe as neo-constitutionalism is compatible with my views. But again, I want to stress that the institutions that you use to implement human rights or to implement the Constitution can vary. And I am, as I said, I am in favor of popular mechanisms for the institutions that will accomplish this goal. Whether the Italians or the Spaniards have that same idea, I don't know.
Well, this interview, it's for the students, for the law students, and we want to know, for understand your thinking, what are the pros and against to using the critical legal theory to think the law?
My view of what we in the U.S. call critical legal theory is that it's extremely valuable. The primary thing that I think is important, at least for law students at the early stages, is what in the critical legal literature here is called the idea of indeterminacy. And that idea is that as you are educated in and become familiar with the legal materials, the materials of legal reasoning, for us, it's cases, but in other systems, it's statutes and codes. As you get familiar with them, you will see, the indeterminacy argument goes, you will see that those materials don't in themselves generate any specific results. If you want to achieve a pro-business result, you can use the materials. If you want to reach a pro-consumer result on the same issue, you could use the same materials. The materials themselves don't tell you what the legal outcome is. Okay, now, understanding that takes a fair amount of work. You have to work with the materials to see that they have this kind of indeterminacy. But once you do that, then you can, and I believe should, infuse the legal reasoning process with policy judgments. So in this case, the business consumer case, would it be better from my point of view, progressive point of view, to rule in favor of the business or in favor of the consumer? That question might get complicated, or the answer to it might be complicated. It's not always the progressive thing to do to rule for consumers. But that's the question that the critical legal perspective opens up.
Well, in your paper, Critical of Rights, you point out that the progressive lawyers overestimate the importance of their work because an erroneous view of the Supreme Court. Why this view is erroneous?
Well, again, this is specifically in the United States. We had, in the terms of our constitutional history, a relatively brief period of maybe 15 to 20 years in which the Supreme Court was ruling in a progressive direction. And then both before that and since then, the court has been, generally speaking, quite conservative. And so the idea that progressives can reliably count on the court to push a progressive agenda forward is just factually not true in the United States. And again, that's the reason for paying attention to popular constitutionalism and ideas about the Constitution outside the courts, where progressives can organize against a conservative Supreme Court.
Well, you have been a hard defender of the idea that the judicial review will strongly limit it, making by this that the Constitution return to the people. How can we do this?
There's an easy doctrinal solution, but reaching it will take a political activity. So the easy doctrinal solution is to develop doctrines familiar in the United States of very great deference by the courts to judgments of democratically elected officials, either legislatures or executives. Minimal or large-scale deference, minimal scope of constitutional review, things like that. I do want to stress that all of this is predicated on the idea that the democratic system is reasonably well functioning. If it isn't, I actually don't have strong views. I think the U.S. system is, roughly speaking, okay, not perfect. But given the U.S. system, I think progressives would be better off focusing on politics rather than on the Supreme Court. In other systems, I will depend on the local politics.
You, as well, Friedman, sustain that we should emphasize in the needs of the persons and not on their rights. How can we do this?
Well, there too, I think there's a conceptual issue, which is that the history of the language of rights, at least in the liberal tradition, has been of human, I don't know, autonomy and individualism. And the language of needs is a language of connectedness and interdependence. I think what that means is that political actors and activists have to start talking about why we are all dependent on each other and why, therefore, we should be responsive to each other's needs rather than assertive of our own rights. It's a transformation in the conceptual space of legal thinking. That obviously takes a long time, and there are no magic routes to that goal. It's just putting these kinds of things out on the legal agenda over and over again.
In Mexico, many people think that law and politics are separated. How can we think the separation is really separated, or are they connected?
Again, I want to go back to the core idea of critical legal studies as I've articulated it. If you think that the legal materials, the law, is indeterminate, but you also know that people are making decisions all the time, you have to figure out why it is or what it is that leads them to make the decisions they do, and then present them as if they are dictated by the law. And the critical legal studies perspective is, well, the reason people have for making the decisions they do is politics. And so there is no separation between law and politics. But to get to that point, from our perspective, you do have to work through the legal materials to show that you could come out any way you wanted.
What does the constitutionalism theory should do?
You work
constitutional in theory, but where is going right now? What are the newest things they have to sell to us?
So my own view is that the important tasks now for constitutional theory are to connect different ways in which constitutional systems work to the underlying political system in which they are located. So in the United States, we have a constitutional system that includes a vigorous Supreme Court and imperfect democratic institutions. And the job of the constitutional theorist is to explain why it is that our constitutional system in all of its parts works the way it does. I don't want to talk about the contemporary Mexican situation, but in theorizing about, say, constitutionalism in Mexico as of 1990, constitutional theorists ought to be thinking about what the relationship was between the PRI and the overall political system, and how that generated a way of thinking about the Constitution as of 1990 that seemed to make sense then. And then, you know, I don't know about the contemporary Mexican situation, but contemporary theorists ought to think about, again, what are the contemporary sort of structural politics in Mexico, and how does that structure get reflected in the way people think about the Constitution?
Do you think constitutional theory can make it progressive? And how can we do that?
So my own view is that the conveying the message that in this more rather complicated way, law and politics can't be separated is a progressive message. So I think that getting that argument out and having law students and lawyers understand it is ultimately a contribution to progressive politics. I don't make large claims for what legal theory or constitutional theory can do in advancing a progressive politics, but it can do something. And it is, I think, the attack on the distinction between law and politics, that is the best contribution we can make.
Well, we have been talking about the people and the constitutions. I saw a term that its name popular constitutionalism. What is that idea? And how can we think that a popular constitutionalism on a reality?
The idea behind popular constitutionalism is that the Constitution is not simply a document that only lawyers and judges own. It's a document that the people themselves also own. And popular constitutionalism asserts that ordinary people, first of all, are entitled to have views about what the Constitution means that are different from the views that the lawyers and other legal specialists have. And more important, that when those views differ, when the people's views differ, lawyers and judges should take, from those of lawyers and judges should take seriously the propositions that the people are asserting about the Constitution. So one way of putting the idea of popular constitutionalism is that it is the people who ultimately give meaning to what to the Constitution. And then once the people have given that meaning, lawyers and judges should implement it.
Well, could you tell us more about your work, your recent work? Where are you working right now, and what we will see in the future about your work?
I've recently published, meaning within the past 3 or 4 years, two books that lay out the kind of argument that I've just been making here. One is called The Constitution of the United States, a Contextual Analysis, which is reasonably technical. And then there's a second book called Why the Constitution Matters, which tries to make the argument in a more accessible way for non-specialists. And the argument in that those books is the argument that I've just made and that I am making in some of the work that I'm doing now, which is to connect the textual Constitution with the way the U.S. political system operates with respect to fundamental values. Just to take a current example, it is a matter of constitutional significance in the United States that we have divided government and polarized political parties. That generates some things about the way the system operates with respect to fundamental values. And thinking about that and identifying how the political system is shaping the Constitution is what my current projects are about.
Well, first, thank you for sharing us your ideas. The intention was that Mexican students, Latin American students, know more about you, know more about the U.S. thinking, know more about the ideas that are working here. It's necessarily to know more about the U.S. constitutionalism works, and we want to share that. Thank you very much for this dialogue.
Well, you're welcome. I hope it's useful to the viewers of this interview.
Thank you very much. Amigos y amigas, muchas gracias. Acabado esta conversación con el profesor Mark Tushner. Estamos aquí en la Universidad de Harvard. Espero les haya gustado y nos seguimos viendo a través del internet.